This program, Between the Flags, which was developed in Australia to improve patient care, has been adopted and adapted by Qatar in the Middle East. Who'd have thought? Sometimes it is through healthcare that countries enact a particular form of soft diplomacy, and that sharing and caring approach has prompted a big, fat, hardcover book called Health Systems Improvement Across the Globe, Success Stories from 60 Countries. Now, that may sound dry, but in fact there are all sorts of inspiring things underway. And to tell us about some of them, I'm delighted to welcome Professor Geoffrey Braithwaite, one of the editors. Geoffrey's Professor of Health Systems Research at Macquarie University and founding director of the Australian Institute of Health Innovation. Hello, Geoffrey.
Hi, Geraldine.
Now, this project sets out with the goal of competence in news content, I suppose, which is a bit of a break from the norm of, you know, alerting people to dysfunction. That was your primary goal, was it?
We wanted to say, where is it that we can see success in health systems and in the way they develop programs to deliver better care to patients? And not just in the rich countries where most of the studies are, not just in OECD countries, but what about in low, middle-income and high-income countries? And what does success look like when you're delivering care in such a complex system?
And people were ready to cooperate with you?
They were champing at the bit. We have to source people who have enough expertise in each of the countries to write an authoritative chapter. And we have some levers to do this, myself and the other editors. I'm the series editor for this series on reform.
You're one of six editors.
Yeah. I enrolled the other five to be regional editors because I didn't want to take on the world without a team to help.
And how many authors then?
151.
My goodness, you were bold. So let's start at home with Between the Flags, which I just mentioned. It certainly sounds very Australian. Why are you highlighting it?
So let me take you back 25 years and let me scare a few listeners. So 25 years ago, if you were an inpatient in a hospital and you started to deteriorate, and the systems were rudimentary, so people didn't notice you were deteriorating, there was no mechanism to arrest that deterioration of the patient until the patient had a cardiac arrest. And then a crash team was sent in to deal with the cardiac arrest. Now, 25 years on, if you think about that, that's insane. Why would you wait until somebody had a cardiac arrest before you sent somebody in to rescue the patient? It's too late. So Ken Hillman, an intensivist at Liverpool Hospital, and a number of other people around the world, started to think that what should happen is somebody who was concerned that the patient was starting to deteriorate should, through their concern or through some clinical indicators, the vital signs of the patient, get some team coming from intensive care unit to address that problem early.
So in other words, this is about medical hierarchies, because the patient who was admitted under a particular doctor for, say, a cardiac issue couldn't be co-referred to somebody from the intensive care team.
Well, that doctor who admits the patient isn't standing by the bedside in a vigil 24/7. So they weren't there when the patient deteriorated, which is often at nighttime or on the weekend or at another time when the admitting clinician isn't there. So there was no mechanism to get permission from that admitting clinician for somebody to do something to their patient.
Amazing.
So it was medical hierarchy, tribalism, all the things that you get in every organisation, I guess.
So the overhaul, and I might add, Ken Hillman is coming up in a special Saturday Extra that we have planned for the next few weeks, because he was one of the guests at a panel I presented at the Sydney Writers' Festival about death and dying. So he's quite a reformer, actually, Ken Hillman. So the name of this study, Between the Flags, gives it away, I suppose. The idea is that you're looking for ways to intervene early, and what you share, the power is shared. Is it like that?
Yeah. There's two things. There's one is you need to have vital signs monitored on a regular basis.
Like an early warning system.
Like an early warning system, the canary in the coal mine. And when the patient moves out from the flags, you need to rescue them. You need to intervene early. And so you need to call the team, the medical emergency team from the intensive care unit, at the early stages of deterioration and arrest.
And do we know that that has made a difference to people's outcomes here in Australia?
In Australia, it's reduced mortality, death, from cardiac arrest by about a third.
My goodness. So once somebody on the initial admission team sees the deterioration, is there a sort of system by which they alert or can sort of grade the person's decline, the patient's decline?
Yep. And so if the person starts to decline and their vital signs indicate that there's a decline on the way, they call, or even if they're concerned and worried about their patient, the nurses on the ward, if they're concerned about their patient, can call their medical emergency team who'll come down. And sometimes that will be for no good reason. So there's a tendency to think clinical professionals will be able to detect this. But if you're a nurse or a doctor on a surgical ward or a medical ward, you're not an expert in patients deteriorating and you're not an intensive care specialist. So you haven't necessarily got all the skills you need to deal with this patient, but you have got the skills to detect it.
And this is where there's this colour-coded, standardised observation chart, I read, which is employed as part of the between the flags, because this matters, because this is what you've exported, basically.
Yes. This is one of the areas where Australia's been in the lead. So this radiated out, this idea of this system and then the system itself in different guises. And we've done a direct transfer to Qatar. We had some colleagues who are working with us on this system in New South Wales who moved to Qatar and took the system with them. And so now there's the Qatar early warning system. They didn't call it between the flags.
And has it gone elsewhere as well?
Yes. This is now a mainstay of hospitals across the world. And that's why I say, you know, it's saved many lives.
Okay, so let's whip across to Ghana, because this is another one in your 150 case studies. Ghana had to tackle a brain drain issue. Now, tell us how that was turned into a patient-saving routine.
So, you know, there's a bigger problem than just Ghana, if I may. Rich countries keep raiding poor countries for their clinical specialists, doctors, nurses, allied health professionals. And yet the people who need more are the countries where they have low levels of income and real need. So Ghana was a country in 2006, it was suffering a quite an extreme brain drain. It's estimated, by the way, that there's 700 doctors in America at the moment, and that's only one country, that are Ghanaian. And if they went back to Ghana,
they'd transform the Ghanaian health system.
It would really help. Ghana's a country about the same size as Australia in population, about 26 million people. Okay, so it was suffering in 2006 from a real brain drain of its best clinicians to the NHS in the UK, in England, and other places. And so it said, we have to address this. At that point, there was one doctor for every 15,000 people. And to give you an idea of the magnitude, in Australia, it's one for every 300 people.
Goodness.
So this is a country with far more needs health-wise than Australia, with far fewer resources. And so it was suffering this brain drain. So they said, we've got to do something about this. And no one's going to help us because they can offer better salaries in the, you know, the OECD wealthy countries. So they did a bit of salary increase to keep people, but that's never enough. They also established a postgraduate medical college to nurture and mentor their own students rather than their own doctors, rather than having to go elsewhere to other countries. They decentralized postings, had a system where people who were doctors who came from a region could go back to that region and act as a doctor in that region. So go back home. And also established policies and systems to strengthen the system and support things. So by 2014, 8 years later, they had increased the number of doctors to one in 8,500 from one in 15,000. Now, that's still nowhere near.
No, what it should be. But I suppose what you're really highlighting is that, and I presume this is what you're trying to say in your book, that if you really do analyse your systems with an open mind and get out from your established conventions, you can be very creative about improving the health of your peoples.
This probably cost not much money, but will have a major impact, a flow-on and ripple effect in Ghana and other countries. The idea of the book is other countries can learn from the Ghanaian experience.
Well, let's go to China now, very much the country in the headlines at the moment. And while we have our My Health Record, the new e-health system for sharing medical information, China, you tell me, is trying something different.
So when you go to developing countries, including China, and you go into the health system, one of the things you notice is patients spend a lot of time waiting for the next thing to happen in a waiting room or in a long queue. China, even in Beijing and Shanghai, has that problem. They've got huge hospitals. By the way, the volume of the problem is massive. There's 900,000 hospitals in China. So, you know, every time you talk about China, don't think, this is like a bigger Australia. Okay. The numbers are unfathomable. So some of the hospitals in Beijing and Shanghai said, why don't we do something about that? So this is IT, information technology capability that's available. Okay. So firstly, let's patients register and get a barcode at the start of interfacing with the hospital so they can book their appointment for the doctor in this large hospital at a time that's good for them, rather than just going and joining a queue. So the doctor is alerted. When they get to the doctor prescribes, say, some pharmaceuticals, some drugs for them, and the pharmacy is alerted in this system. They can also book, at the end of the process, another appointment. And also they can learn what the costs are, so they can and be billed. So this is the dream of every hospital administrator, of course, for a one-stop talking shop of all the things that people need. It's very complex to do, but this self-service encounter system in tertiary hospitals initiative of some of the hospitals in China has cracked this and got this system, which is much more user-friendly.
Does that interface with the, you know, the whole barefoot doctor story of China, which is an old story, I know, but, you know, that was the argument that they, a bit like Cuba, I suppose, did actually develop very good on-the-ground treatment. Does that dovetail?
It's probably the electronic version of that, isn't it, when you think about it? The barefaced doctor knew you, was in a village and dealt with the community's health by knowledge. This is encoding that knowledge in an IT system, but in a much bigger...
And it has reduced the queues, has
and
it?
It's reduced the queues. And there's lots of reports in our chapter of this being more efficient. The patients are, you know, flowing through the system better.
Okay, the final focus is Denmark, which found 15 years ago that it had the highest rate of cancer of all the Nordic countries and the lowest survival rate as well. How did they start to tackle this problem?
One of the things we've learned from this book and really from other work that we do internationally in my research institute is that you can spend a lot of time trying to reform the health system or improve it. But if you don't start with what the patient needs and what the patient wants and really elicit that from consumers, you're likely not to deliver what you want to deliver. Now, that seems like the A, B, C, D, E, F staged sort of obvious thing to do. But, you know, it's that old business aphorism, always figure out what the consumer wants and then deliver it to them. Denmark's a smaller country. It's an OECD country like Australia, but it's got 5.5 million people and full of those Nordic sort of values. So Denmark's looked at its data on cancer patients and noticed that the care it was providing was very fragmented. In other words, person would go to the GP, get a diagnosis, then be referred to a specialist. Then that was a different episode of care. So it was all very episodic and fragmented. And it also had cancer outcomes for its patients that were less favorable than the other Nordic countries, the other Scandinavian countries. So I wanted to do something about that. So 15 years ago, it started on a journey of saying we have to treat this as a patient journey, and we have to understand the pathways that patients go through from a clinical point of view, but also what they experience from a patient point of view. Encode that in a pathway, giving patients advice along the way and options for their trajectory all the way through the system.
And what was the result of changing this approach?
Well, not only have they now got as good as in some cancers and better in other cancers than the other Nordic countries, but this system has now been radiated out to the other Nordic countries who previously they were behind. So it's made them jump ahead. It might sound to your listeners like common sense, but it's a very complex thing if you get cancer and then have to navigate through a health system through to being in remission. Lots of options, lots of things can happen to you. You go for surgery or radiotherapy or medical oncology. Where do you need counselling? So they've encoded this in a number of pathways, and that means the clinicians and the patients are alert to what happens next.
And look, finally, this whole business of transferability seems to be an important part of what you're trying to do with this book. So all the stories you've chosen can be copied, can they? They're not so culturally specific?
We've chosen stories that, of course, they're embedded in their own context. And the Australian health system is unique and different from the Chinese and the Ghanaian and Danish health system. But they're all systems improvements with the patient in mind. They started small and radiated out. We call that the acorn to oak tree principle. They start with a bit of a pilot and then work their way up to success. They rely on data intelligence, people and information systems, and they're all a product of collaboration within the health system. And now what this book does is say, we can collaborate about all these success stories across the rest of the world.
Well, look, congratulations. It's fabulous to see such constructive behaviour acknowledged. And more power to you. I hope there's a second edition. Thank you, Geoffrey Braithwaite.
Thank you indeed.
And Geoffrey is Professor of Health Systems Research at Macquarie University, one of six editors of Health Systems Improvement Across the Globe, Success Stories from 60 Countries. It's published by CRC Press. It does include West Africa and Ebola, one of the most feared diseases, which of course has struck again. And I'm told that there's another book in this series which explores the shape of health systems in 2030.